May I have your attention, please? The following is not the real Jeff Foxworthy.
If you wear gloves while beekeeping for no other reason than it's easier than picking the propolis off your fingers, you might be a beekeeper. If you talk to your bees more than you talk to your spouse, you might be a beekeeper. If you smell a newly opened jar of honey before tasting it, you might love honeybees.
Welcome, welcome to Bee Love Beekeeping Podcast, presented by our good friends over at Man Lake. And hey, a special thanks goes out to the not real Jeff Foxworthy for that fun intro. At Bee Love, we're all about honeybees and, of course, the beekeepers. And if you're on the beekeeping adventure, we would love to hear from you. If you're just thinking about it, this is a great place to learn from real live beekeepers. Bees, beekeepers, and fun beekeeping stories, it's all about the love. Before we go all the way to Hawaii for our interview today with Jasmine Joy, I've got to mention this news story that keeps popping up in my feed. I don't know what to think of this. I welcome your feedback. The headline reads, "Artificial light found to disrupt the circadian cycle of vital ecosystems and economic pollinators." Now, they're talking specifically about bees here, and let me just read you a few quotes from one of the articles. "Disrupted sleep cycles are a well-known concern for human health and function, and now researchers have found similar impacts on insects. A new study has found that artificial light disrupts the circadian rhythms of honeybees and poses a threat to their essential role as pollinators." Now, this study comes out of the University of California, San Diego, and it found that light disruption is not only a health concern for humans, but also for honeybees. Quote, "Our research shows just how sensitive honeybees are to changes in their environment, particularly to something as seemingly benign as artificial light. Honeybees generally prefer to nest in dark environments." So let me just interject here, because I don't really get this, because inside my beehives, it's pretty dark even during the daytime. Little light comes in through the entrance, but at night, even if there's a little ambient light, it's got to be very dark in there, doesn't it? So this is what this whole study was about. Now, if you read really closely, it sounds like the way that they actually did this study was to keep honeybees in a completely lit environment, so much, much brighter than inside a hive. So take this all with a grain of salt, but how often at night, even in an urban kind of setting, unless you've got a great big old spotlight on your hive or something, are they really getting much light from outside? So as soon as I bring that up, I read this. "Bees sleep outside when they swarm or when they form bee beards outside the nest on hot evenings, which are increasing under climate change." Now, this part I thought was kind of interesting, actually. It says sleep is crucial for the health and fitness of honeybee colonies since they depend on an intricate system of communication known as the waggle dance that informs hive mates about the location of food sources in the environment. Here's the interesting part. "Bees dance more poorly and therefore do not communicate as well if they do not get enough sleep." I don't know what you want to do with this information. For most people, I don't think it's going to make any changes in what you do, keeping bees whatsoever. If you find yourself in maybe a really bright place, maybe you're in an urban environment, you have a beehive on the roof of a building that has spotlights on it or something, I don't know, maybe you put some kind of a shade canopy over the front or something so that they're not getting that direct light. Anyway, honeybees need to sleep too. Maybe these days when the girls are just really grumpy, it's because they didn't have enough sleep. Now let's go on over to Hawaii and find out what it's like doing beekeeping in a beautiful place. I'd like to welcome our special guest today, Jasmine Joy, all the way from beautiful Hawaii. Aloha.
Aloha, Eric. Mahalo for having me on your podcast. Be love.
Well, you're so very welcome. Yes, it's all about the love of bees. And when I think of love of bees, you're one of the first people that comes to mind. Because I visited your apiary about 4 years ago when it was in a different location, but it was so beautiful and so peaceful. And you are someone so at tune with your girlfriends, the honeybees.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was great having you in the apiary. You and Gil, correct? You and Gil came out.
Yes.
B-rolls of my girls.
B-rolls of your girls. And Joey was our cameraman that day.
Yeah, we had some good fun.
And he was brave. Gil stayed about a mile away. Joey put on a bee suit, no gloves, so he could operate the camera, and he did a pretty good job.
Were my girls pretty nice to you guys?
They were very nice. They were very well behaved. But as you told me, you had told them ahead of time, these nice people are coming, be on your best behavior. You had a whole conversation. And before we ever turned on a camera, we sat down with them for about 20 minutes and relaxed. And it was a great experience. So thank you again for that. But we're not here to talk about that today. We want to know what it is like to keep bees in Hawaii, because it seems like it would be so easy because there's flowers everywhere and the weather's perfect. And is that the case? You can be honest.
I wouldn't say anything a part of apiculture is easy. It's very much blood, sweat, and tears, but good tears, tears of joy.
Yeah. So what kinds of pest problems do you have there?
Well, we do have the varroa mite here, and we have the small hive beetle. We got the wax moth, but that's not a big deal unless you just have old equipment and your hive's already dead. But between the varroa mite and this African small hive beetle, those thrive here. We can talk first about the small hive beetle, because I have more enlightening news about the varroa mite, which is good to talk about on this podcast.
Let's do it.
The small hive beetle, I remember you were telling me, or when you came to the apiary, Eric, that it was your first time seeing the beetles, correct?
Well, yeah, I live in a cold climate and we just don't have them. We have plenty of varroa and plenty of other problems, but yeah, the beetles are not there. So tell us how you deal with them.
I like to call them the Darth Vaders of the hive, because they just look like little black helmets walking around. They're scavengers. They come from the grasslands area right below the Sahara Desert in Africa. So the climate there is pretty similar to here in Hawaii. And so they thrive here. And they were originally first found in Florida, outside of Africa, within the United States. And then just through, I guess, migratory beekeeping, somehow they ended up here in Hawaii. I can't tell you exactly how the beetles got here, because the honeybee was introduced to Hawaii in 1857. So that's 167 years ago we're talking about. And the honeybee being an introduced species to Hawaii, we're talking about Hawaii is the extinction, and I believe it has the most invasive and it's the extinction and invasive capital of the world, invasive species. And so the honeybees are great because although they're introduced, they're not invasive, they're beneficial. And even though they're introduced here, this is one of the most favorable places in the world to keep honeybees. Canada and the mainland United States rely on Hawaii, on our queen bee production here. They would be nowhere at their stature of apiculture in either of those regions if it wasn't for Hawaii.
And that's mostly on the Big Island, right?
Yeah, that's mostly on the Big Island. And boy, Eric, I've learned so much in this past year. We can kind of touch base on outside of Oahu as well, on other islands, because in spring next year, I'll actually be fully moving to Kauai, the island of Kauai, which is the most northern island, that's habitable. I mean, there's Ni'ihau, but it's owned by the Robinson family, and that's just neighboring it. But Kauai's up there, and Kauai doesn't have mites. Yeah, they do not have mites.
Now, I had heard that about Molokai also.
I was about to say, Molokai is the other one that doesn't have, but the rest of the islands have the mites.
Finnish small hive beetle, do you have any magic solutions that other people can use?
Well, you know, I'm going on 14 years of being a bee guardian, of tending to these beautiful sacred honeybees, and I've tried many, many modalities. I'm a treatment-free beekeeper, so that means I'm not using any pesticides. What I do use, though, when I first started beekeeping and caring for Honeygirl Organics Hives, which is the organic skincare company, it was my gateway into apiculture. I co-managed their creamery department and manufactured their whole product line. So they're making skincare from products in the hive, the beeswax, the honey. And I learned how to rescue. I did one structural removal for bee rescuers or bee removal specialists, we say cut out. I did with the founder of Honeygirl Organics, and then I ran with it and started Bee Leaf Hawaii in 2012. I started beekeeping in 2011. 2012, I started Bee Leaf Hawaii.
Let me just take a minute here to thank our presenting sponsor, Man Lake. Years before they became a sponsor, I was buying bee supplies from them. While they don't have a store near me, I've had great experiences with their customer service and shipping right to my home. They're passionate about bees and dedicated to helping beekeepers. You can tell. American-made products with a commitment to quality craftsmanship and innovation. From woodenware to feeds, you can trust Man Lake. And maybe the best part, Man Lake is offering a discount to Bee Love Beekeeping listeners. Click on the link in the show notes and use the special discount code to get $10 off your purchase of $100 or more.
And at the time, exterminators were still allowed to kill honeybees here. And then a few years after that, they were deemed a threatened species. And then now they're not allowed to kill them unless they're aggressive and they're considered a pest, right? So with the African small hive beetle, they thrive here because, like I said, the climate is very similar to the grasslands below the Sahara Desert. They can smell honey supposedly like miles away. If there's like a thriving hive somewhere, they can smell it miles away, fly to it, go inside of the hive. They'll lay eggs inside of the hive. And then, so this is their life cycle. The beetles lay eggs inside of the hive. They hatch. Now they turn into like little maggots. They're really disgusting. They look exactly like a maggot. And in that form, they see the light of the entrance of the hive. And they're like, oh, the light. They get all entrapped.
Go to the light.
I think of like the minions with the big eyes. And so they crawl out and they pupate in the soil below the hives. So one way of IPM is I have weed mat. I have one of my apiaries is on concrete like slabs. So that is already, it slows down their just the life cycle of that larva crawling out and crawling into and pupating in the soil, right? Now in places where in apiaries where my hives are on, they're on hive stands, of course, but then there's just dirt, grass, whatever below them. I have weed mat. Before I even bring, when I'm installing an apiary, that's the first thing I'm doing is clearing the land and putting weed mat down to also prevent all the weeds from growing around the hives. Which, and, you know, us beekeepers know bees are sensitive to vibration and sound, so they don't like the weed whacker. They're going to come out all not happy and possibly stink, and we're maintaining all our weeds and everything like that. So there's one form of IPM already, weed mat. And then one thing I learned along the years is there's this Spanish, they either call it like Spanish or Cuban oregano. It's a pretty big leaf and it's fuzzy and it's thick. And we were installing that oregano below the, you know, making holes, little pukas in the weed mat and just installing it, planting it right under the apiary. And then we saw that the beetle count started to go down. So it must be something in the oils of that oregano that they don't like. You know, it kind of burns their exoskeleton, or it probably burns the worms when they're trying to pupate in that soil.
That's cool.
Right?
All right. Out with the Darth Vaders.
Okay.
You sounded excited about something you have for Varroa. What are you doing there?
Okay. So every year we have an annual beekeepers meeting at UH University of Hawaii at Manoa, and UH Honeybee Project hosts it. A couple years ago, they had, I want to say his name's Dr. Stephen Martin. I don't have my notes on me, but I'm pretty sure that's his name. And he's from England area, right? Like London, England, around that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dr. Ethel Villalobos, she's the founder and she runs the UH Honeybee Project. So she's been working with him, and she had him as a guest speaker at our annual beekeepers meeting. And it was so just refreshing, and it filled my honey heart, I like to say, because I've been a treatment-free beekeeper my whole career as a beekeeper. Now, I think there's way more beekeepers that treat than do not. And so at this meeting, he was speaking about the studies that they've been doing, is that bees over time, because of all the mites and their own adaptability in nature, in the wild, what they do is something called recapping. And if we're doing inspections in our hives, and you look at the brood and you look at the cappings of the brood, if they don't look seamless, like if that brood capping doesn't, if it looks like there's small perforations in it, there's a high chance that your bees are highly hygienic. Therefore, in the recapping process, the bees are, when there's mites in a cell, the bees are able to detect it. They reopen that capped brood cell with a pupa in it, and they cannibalize their own brood.
And what happens to the mite when they do that?
Well, once they cannibalize their own brood, that mite scurries out, and it's just...
Yeah.
You know, I guess the mite is still present, but at least they're uncapping it, and then the queen's able to lay another egg in there, and then they're recapping, and supposedly there's no mite.
Yeah. The mite doesn't have a host.
Right. Isn't that crazy? But it's cool.
So how do we encourage them to do that more? Or is it just a matter of, here's something genetic that I'm seeing and I want to keep these genetics going?
See, that question, if you were to ask somebody else that isn't a bee rescuer or a bee removal specialist as myself, they would definitely give you another answer. For me, every single colony I've ever owned has been rescued. And I'm proud to say I've never even bought a queen bee in my whole life. Because having multiple hives, I'm able to, if there's a weak hive, I could pull from another hive and pump up that weak hive again. If that weak hive is just really on its way out, and you know, I've, in my beginning years of beekeeping, I was crying when my hives got slimed by the beetles and just would lose hives. And over time, I've learned that the bees have really taught me how to learn, or to just transmute the grieving process and accept that they come and they go. And I'm a very spiritual person. And I do believe in reincarnation, and I do believe. And so I pray to my bees, and the ones that don't make it, I always just pray that they come back an even more golden, healthy, holy, pumping hive, and or something else, not bee. Maybe they want to be something else.
Yeah. So it's part of the life cycle. It's part of nature, and it's okay.
Yep. And bringing it back to that, Eric, and that's where I was trying to say, is the difference is if you were to ask just a beekeeper that's just like a hobbyist or a backyard beekeeper versus somebody that's a conservationist as myself, is that it's the bees in the wild here that have grown this adaptability of this recapping process. And so what Dr. Stephen Martin was saying is that Hawaii, specifically O'ahu, has the potential to be the first place with mites, but to be mite free, because maybe it's more like mite resistant.
Yeah.
Because of this adaptation.
I think that's it. There can be mites, but if they don't bother my bees, who cares?
Exactly. And so toward the end of this meeting, he made the suggestion to all the beekeepers in the room that if they are treating, that they start weaning off their bees from treatment.
Wow.
Because I've never treated my bees, so they're already ahead of the game. And I do believe in survival of the fittest. So because I'm rescuing these colonies, I end up the strongest stocks and genetics of bees end up surviving in my apiaries. So here in Hawaii, since the honeybee was introduced in 1857, we only have two genetics. The first bees that came, they brought them. First of all, they tried to bring a hive all the way from the East Coast, and the hive melted before it even got to Hawaii. So they're like, okay, that's not going to happen. So they decided to bring it from San Jose, California, and they put the hive on a block of ice on the Fanny Major, is the name of the ship. And then it came to Hawaii. There were these brothers in Nu'uanu area, you know, the Pali area.
Yeah.
That's why if you go to the lookout there, Eric, you'll see a sign that says flying bees, be aware. Because Nu'uanu was the first place that the bees, when they were introduced to Hawaii, they were situated in a yard of these brothers that cared for them. And from just, I think there were three hives, those bees started to swarm. And then I want to say a year or two after, they brought more genetics. And so the two genetics that we have here are dark German and Italian.
The Pali is so windy. How do they even fly?
That's what I'm saying. That's why the sign is there, because the bees, like, they can barely fly around because it's so...
Yeah, they're all erratic. Okay, I'm going to really notice that closer the next time I'm there. Thank you for opening my eyes to that. Are there any seasonality issues? Are there any dearth times at all?
You know, I've been observing climate change into crisis since 2018 in my journals and my logs. And there was a year, I want to say it was 2021, around there, 2020, 2021. It was just like the beginning of the pandemic. And I get a call from the Waimanalo Polo Field. And there's a lady that runs an equestrian program. I have so much respect for equestrians. I feel like they're similar to beekeepers, where horses are so special and intuitive. If you don't have a relationship and a kinship with the horse, that horse is going to buck you off like the bees sting you, you know? So just the bees always bring me to the coolest, most magical places. I appreciate that so much. So what was happening there, she had a section in the polo field where she was running tours with like children, adults too, but mostly children, where it was like that, building that relationship, trusting. I think it was bareback on the horses, things like that. And she calls me up one day and she goes, "Hi, do you think you could come assess a situation that's going on here? There's bees that are coming and eating the food that I'm feeding my horses." And I said, "What?" She goes, "Yeah, and one of my horses got stung and won't eat anymore," because she knows that the bees keep going to the trough there where the feed is. And she won't eat. And I was like, "Oh no, poor horse." Well, they're that smart too. The horse is like, "Heck no, I'm not going to go over there and get stung again."
Well, and bees don't eat horse food.
No. So check this out, Eric. What happened is I get there and I see the bees. So the horses eat soy, little pellets that literally look like pollen pellets.
Oh.
And the bees are on the ground with the, it's basically like edamame pellets, right? And so the bees are on the ground packing these soy pellets on their legs like pollen, which when you think about it, if it's like edamame, this is GMO, because soy is one of the four major GMO crops. And the fact that I saw that, I put it all together that there's not enough pollen in the trees. And that year we had a drought. Like we did not get a lot of rain that season. And we were just coming out of winter going into spring. And when I saw that, I was like, wow, the flora around us isn't even producing enough protein for the bees, which is their pollen intake, and they need that. You know, they can't just live off of nectar. They need a balanced diet, just as like us human beings.
That is really interesting. And for those that don't know the geography around there, Waimanalo is not a dry place.
Yeah.
There are dry parts of the island. Waimanalo is green and it's near the mountains. And well, in fact, that's where your apiary was. And it was, yeah. So it was just dry enough that even though probably things looked green, they weren't creating pollen.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, and to add on to Waimanalo, it is an agricultural area. So a lot of our invasive species end up concentrated there. Like, there's huge iguanas there right now, and they're not anywhere else on the island. And we're like, oh my God, keep those iguanas there in Waimanalo.
Those are not native to there, by the way.
No. Even the Koki frogs, which are from Big Island, anytime they hear one, Department of Ag will spend night and day finding it. Well, they come out at night, so they'll go listen to it and then just find it and spray it, and it's done.
I have read about that, and I get it. Where my daughter lives on the Big Island, all night long you hear the Koki frogs, but I love it. To me, it is so relaxing, but they're surprisingly loud, and I know they don't want them to hit all the other islands. How are they going to keep varroa mites from Kauai? Because they can hitch a ride on a barge or a boat and accidentally get over there. Ask the people in Australia.
Yeah, it's been this way for so many years now. I hope that we can continue that. But like, that's prohibited. We're not even allowed to be moving bees island to island.
Sure.
And as I mentioned, when the bees were introduced in 1857, 50 years after that, they prohibited any more outside bees from coming in. Because within 50 years, we were thriving already just by the bees that were swarming from those two genetics that they brought in.
And they must have been good genetics.
Yeah, like I had the honor and privilege of rescuing bees from Iolani Palace in August of 2020 in the pandemic. And they were concerned that those were Africanized bees because there was a beehive in every tower corner of the palace. And they were coming down and stinging tourists and stinging guests and stinging even the security guards. So they took, they found a dead one or whatever, grabbed a specimen and gave it to UH Honeybee Project. And Dr. Ethel Villalobos goes, no, they're just dark Germans.
Oh, thank goodness there's nothing Africanized over there. At this point, tell me about some of the things that you do business-wise. So you mentioned removals.
Yep.
And is that the majority of what you do?
That's what Bee Leaf Hawaii is founded on. And we are the lead bee removal company on Oahu, at least. The type of work that we do is historical, industrial, commercial. We do residential, and that's how we started off. So yeah, we help the auntie and uncle and the tutus and everything. And I give them more of a personable, I'm very personable with all my clients, but I like to give the kupuna, our elders, I give them a little discount. They're just living off of their retirement and they're so grateful for that, you know? And I'm just grateful that them being as elders, they have the consciousness and awareness of keeping these bees alive, because a lot of these older generations are like, kill the bees. They don't even think about it because they didn't grow up in the time of this scarcity. Of everything, kind of it, of the whole natural world and the pollinators, and they're so important. So I'm founded as a bee removal service. And then it was 2015, so 3 years after starting the bee removal business, was when I started to pivot and expand. And then the full circle, or full hexagon, I like to say, of Bee Leaf Hawaii is rescue, relocate, rehabilitate, and educate. So the bees that I rescue, I relocate them to my partnership farms, bee sanctuaries, and then I rehabilitate them with so much love and holistic methods of caring for them. And then the education, the last part, is what I just did today. I started my first outreach class of this school year, and this is my 7th anniversary of doing, it's called the Pollinator Outreach Program. So I call it POP. And I've been bringing my rescued bees to schools for over 7 years now. And it fills my heart to everything I do that Bee Leaf Hawaii encompasses, from saving the bees. And that's hard work. It's like being a demolition construction worker, cutting open structures and just using my infrared camera to even identify established beehives inside of the wall. And the reason I'm able to pick up where they're at is because they have the same heat as a human body. They're 97 degrees in a wall, and that's why my thermal imager can pick them up. So from there, to that full hexagon or full circle in bringing these bees to schools. And then my latest program, Eric, and I started it after you had come to the apiary, is called Beleave University, and it's a beekeeping school. And I'm about to launch my first virtual course, but it will be my fifth cohort that I'll be teaching. So I just this year wrapped up my fourth in-person cohort. I have 18 graduates out of these last four cohorts. Each cohort, I max it out at six students. So I had five in my first one, three in the second, four in the third, and five in this last one.
And is that a one-time class or once a week or how does that work?
It's a 16-week program, and they would come every Thursday from 10 to 2 to my partnership farm, Hoa Aina Omakaha in Waianae on the west side.
16 weeks, that's pretty thorough.
16 weeks. And so how I break it down quarterly. I'll tell you the titles, but I break it down. The first quarter is about spirit of the bee. The second is mind. The third is body. And the last is environment. And so in that first quarter, it's called superorganism psyche. I attune my students to tap into their intuition and feel into their honey hearts. And I have this formula that I channeled. I tell my students, when it comes to beekeeping, this is the formula. It's 3S before 2T. The 3S stands for sight, scent, and sound. Before 2T is taste and touch. So these are our five senses. And we can smell, we can hear, and we can see. We can watch the entrance of a hive. We can smell what's wafting out of the entrance, and we can listen to their hum, their buzz, before we even open that hive and touch a frame or taste that honey. The inspection already starts there.
Absolutely. We have a good idea of what's going on.
Yeah.
I mean, I get it. Commercial beekeepers, they've got 1,000 hives. They've got to just book through it all. For those of us that are hobbyists or like you that can take the time, I recommend take the time. Spend some time quieting yourself before you even get near the bees so you can be more in tune. We actually considered calling this podcast Intuitive Beekeeping, but we like Bee Love better. It's so much about being intuitive, I believe. I'm not quite as into it. I can't communicate with my bees as well as you can, but there are plenty of times, don't tell some people that I'm saying this, but where I ask them, what do you need? I can tell you need something. You've got a problem here, and there's eight different ways that we can approach it. What do you need? What's going to be best for you? And I really try to listen. I can't say I'm great at it, but I'm trying.
Just to hear you say that, Eric, it makes me happy, because you being a male beekeeper, and in the world of apiculture, there's so many male beekeepers, and I think a lot of them too are on the more conventional side, right? And for me, there's this symbolism in the patriarchy. You know, in this last decade, we've all been watching this whole patriarchy just kind of like slowly crumble in many facets. And I look to the bees like I look to the world. I look at the superorganism of the hive and the matriarchy. Like, if we as a human species would honor Mother Earth the way that her daughters, even the drones, like the drone passes on his, I call them kamikaze king bees. They mate with her in the sky. They pass on their lineage. They have an explosive orgasm and fall to the ground.
What a way to go. Come on. Don't feel sorry for him.
And did you ever see the meme? It said, Honey Nut Cheerio.
Yes.
Poor drones. But can you imagine, Eric, if like we honored as a human race the planet as her offspring honor her, the queen, how much more harmonious this place would be.
All right, we're running out of time. You wanted to talk about the Big Island. What's going on over there? Is it just the queens?
Yes, it has a lot to do with the queens. And I'm not going to throw any organizations or companies under the bus by naming names, but let's just say that I've learned so much this year about GMO bees, genetically modified organism bees. The artificial insemination of just queen breeding already, there's a dishonor. Just the way that it's done, how they even take the queens before they ship them off and they put them, like, they gas them in a bag so that they just kind of basically fall asleep for a little bit. And I'm just like, oh my God, like,
if we have a queen breeder on the Big Island listening, you're welcome to come on the show and give your side of the story.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have no daggers to throw at anybody in that doing those things. I'm just representing myself and what I believe in. And I come from a neutral stance. I'm not here to judge any other beekeepers. I know we're all very quirky, very, very eccentric, and all very different. And that's it. I'm just here sharing what I believe in is pono, which is righteous and just and balance. And whoever feels inspired to learn from me, I just hold the deepest space for them and a very safe container of mentorship, guardianship, so that really what it is, Believe University, and the way that I teach is stewardship, not just for the bees, it's for the whole planet. It's for all sentient beings.
By the way, if people want to look you up, you keep saying Believe, whether it's university or Hawaii. It's BeeLeaveHawaii.com.
Yeah.
By the way, they can find you. It'll be in the show notes. I have two more questions for you, then I need to let you go. One is, I want to hear one wild and crazy beekeeping story from you.
Ooh, one wild beekeeping story.
Something that stands out that was like, oh, I can't believe that happened, or it was painful, or it was embarrassing, or we all have them. Come on.
I mean, there was one time where I was in an industrial place and there were at least four beehives in the building. And it was my handyman and I were just on the job site and we were on his truck. And since it was a pretty big building, he was like, okay, jump on. And he thought I was holding onto his truck. And then he just started driving and I just like rolled, tuck and rolled off the truck. And he was like, oh my God. And I go, you're lucky. I'm a retired professional skimboarder and I know how to fall. But I was okay. I just kind of scuffed my elbow. But
you didn't have any bees land on top of you or anything?
Probably, but no.
That would have been even better. Anyway, that's a good one. What, Jasmine, what brings you joy of beekeeping?
Knowing that I can provide these nature's true alchemists, these little fairies, these little devas, that I can provide them beautiful sanctuaries to thrive in, and that they're going out into the world creating these beautiful sacred geometric shapes all around, like healing our world, feeding us. And I've always known that I wanted to make this world a better place since I was a little girl and help humans and animals. And I get to do all of it through the bees by taking care of them, and they're feeding us. And that is what truly fills my honey heart and brings me joy all the time.
Thank you. Well, you even have joy in your name, Jasmine Joy. Mahalo.
Malankeke.
Appreciate you being with me today.
Thank you so much.
And our tip of the day is something that I was reminded of while having that conversation with Jasmine. And that is, take your time. Do whatever it takes to be relaxed. Observe the bees, smell, listen. I once had it described to me as, pretend like you're doing Tai Chi. Slow, rhythmic movements. Your bees will love you for it. And I also have a question of the day. I recently was on a beekeeping social media site where someone posted a photo of their hives all ready for winter and asked if the ventilation looked okay. Trying to be helpful, I responded that in cold climates, bees still need ventilation to control the humidity in the hive. Immediately, of course, someone else slammed on me saying that bees self-ventilate, so close up your hives almost completely with just one little tiny entrance and that's it. This is one of those beekeeping things where there are so many factors involved and there are so many different opinions. So if you have some profound thoughts on winter hive ventilation in cold climates, please send an email to eric@belovebeekeeping.com. Same with any other feedback that you have for the show. Thank you so much for joining us here on Be Love Beekeeping, presented by Man Lake. Please right now hit those follow or subscribe buttons. And remember, if you're not just in it for the honey or the money, you're in it for the love. See you next week.